I don't believe that Bob Lazar, I don't think that Bob Lazar is lying. I believe that Bob Lazar is omitting information. I believe there's something missing in the story. There's a couple of things missing in the story. One of the things that I have trouble with is the trip to Los Alamos with a piece of Element 115. There's a piece missing in that story. There's an omission there, and I'll leave it at that.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. As always, my name is Andy, and I'm joined today by the director of the award-winning number one documentary across probably multiple countries and continents at this point. It's been out a couple of weeks, S4, The Bob Lazar Story. Welcome, Luigi Venditelli. Luigi, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great. I apologize. I'm going to say in advance, my voice is a little rusty, so it's just because I've been talking too much for the past few days.
Well, no wonder. It's been a couple of weeks, a bit of a whirlwind couple of weeks, I imagine, since
Oh
the
my God.
documentary came out, and we are going to talk all about it. The design, I've got a kind of admission to make to you, which is a half apology, half going to let you tell your side of something, because I got slated in YouTube comments for a comment I made while reviewing said documentary. But I'm man enough to hold my hand up, Luigi, but we'll get to that. We're not going to get there yet. And I
Okay.
never told you that before I hit record either. So
Okay.
all natural reaction here, folks.
I love
Okay.
it. Okay.
Great for the algorithm. But
Yeah,
listen, let's talk about,
it is.
we're
Yeah.
going to talk about Bob a lot because of what Bob Lazar, what we're going to be talking about. But let's talk about Luigi first. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what's brought you to the point in your life you're making documentaries with the mysterious Bob Lazar.
If to make it a short intro, first of all, I'm a business person. I've been in merchandising for almost 25, about over a little over 25 years of my life. I've been making products, tangible products, for a long time. I've made products for the National Hockey League, for transit commissions. A lot of times when brands make products with their brand on it, they hire guys like me to do it, and you never find out about us. We're always in the back end. So I did that for 25 years. But I got into the UFO research world very young and became in 1987. So I'm actually 51. It's my birthday today, by the way. So
Happy
it just,
birthday.
so thank you. And I just turned 51, which, by the way, is an interesting number considering the film I just put out about Area
It is,
51.
yep.
Yeah. I got involved in this when I was very young because of my grandfather. He saw a flying saucer. I found out about it when I was 9 years old. I got really intrigued about flying saucers because he had seen one. And eventually, at the age of about 12, 13, I found out about MUFON, and I became the youngest member in the world of MUFON, which was really exciting because I got to finally start getting literature and books and stuff about flying saucers because I couldn't find any at the time. Living in Montreal, Canada, in the 80s, there was very limited flying saucer literature to buy. Anyway, I eventually grew ranks into that over the years and became the national director for Canada of MUFON. I spent years investigating cases across Canada, whether they be simple close encounters of the first kind, people who've seen lights in the sky, all the way to close encounters of the fourth kind, people who've had contact with apparent beings of some type. So I've covered everything over the years. Worked closely with David Jacobs for close for almost 2 years. He was my almost like a mentor to me in the abduction cases, abduction field, where people have had these experiences where they think they've been taken, and learned a lot about that. He's considered to be one of the most well-respected abduction experts in the world, and he trained me for 2 years. After that, I got involved in working alongside one of the witnesses that was at the Ariel Primary School in Africa in 1994. Spent 10 years by her side in researching that case, helping also had a small part in helping Randall Nickerson with the documentary Aerial Phenomenon, which I highly recommend people watch. It's an incredibly well done doc.
Definitely.
And And then eventually began, because of my work with Emily, Emily Trim was the name of that person that was at Ariel. She's passed away a year and a half ago, unfortunately, at the age of 38, cancer got her and broke my heart. I had the intention of starting an organization called We Are Not Alone, WANA, because of what Emily had explained that she experienced as a little girl growing up, having experienced something very unique. And we've turned that into a channel now. And we are very happily building it. And we hope WANA becomes the go-to place for very good quality, very high quality content on this subject matter. Our film, the S4 the Bob Lazar story, is the very first big piece we put out. And it was almost like a way for us to show this is the type of quality we're going to be putting out on WANA. And this is kind of in a nutshell what I've been up to for a long time.
Wow. First off, on Emily, I never got to speak to Emily Trim. It was tragic when I heard that she'd passed away. Just today, I've literally come back from the funeral of a really good friend of mine who died of cancer a couple of weeks ago. So cancer sucks. So, and I've got listeners who get in touch with me to say they're going through chemo. They're in various different stages. I've had a few that have passed away. Some have recovered and are getting a lot better. And, you know, if this kind of stuff, listening and watching, helps you out, then, you know.
I just found out that I spent a lot of my childhood in Italy. And today, because it was my birth, I kind of got a bad news from Italy on my birthday. But one of my very close cousins is unfortunately not well. And I'm going to have to go to Italy. And cancer sucks. And it's the reality of the world. So if ever there's a time to say fuck something, it's fuck cancer, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely. And you can comment that below, folks, especially if you're on YouTube and whatnot. People tend to feel free. But yeah, it does suck. And segueing into kind of some of the nicer stuff in the world right now, 100% recommend Randall Nickerson's Ariel School documentary. I've had Randall on at the time reviewing it, speaking about it. Wonderful documentary. MUFON side of things for yourself, really interesting. And before we get to talking about the documentary of yours, what is your favorite case you've ever investigated with all that work you've done over the years?
My favorite case I ever, well, there's two of them. One of them is a case in a place north of Montreal in the Laurentians, called the Laurentians. It's kind of like the the ski hills on the outskirts of Montreal. It's about 45 minutes to an hour north of Montreal. And between 2013 and 2017, I investigated what was numerous black triangular craft sightings in that area by many, many different witnesses. And I found that to be one of the most compelling, interesting cases I've ever covered, because there were so many people who saw it that it clearly, something was flying. There was no question something was out there, because it was multiple people from different parts of that area who did not know each other and had been calling it in, going, they saw a black triangular craft at very low altitude, you know, flying it with no sound over the treetops. Hmm. So I consider that to be one of the most interesting investigations I've ever worked on. I actually worked on it for 2.5 years back then, and got to meet a lot of the witnesses, and do absolutely wholeheartedly believe that a lot of people did see something. It wasn't something that they saw far away. It was something that was relatively close. So they were able to describe, obviously, the shape, the color, the lights on it. So something very unusual, non-conventional, about the size of a small house, was flying around over the Laurentians between 2013-2017, witnessed by over 50 different people. So if I look at all the cases I've ever covered, that's the one I had most hands-on. And it was just an overwhelming amount of witnesses. And I thought, if all these people are, and by the way, 90% of those witnesses never wanted to go public. They just wanted to say, look, we saw this, but we don't want to be associated because they're scared of the stigma, which I think, you know, lends a lot of credibility to a lot of people's accounts. If they don't want to even be known, why would they take the time to do that? So that was a big one. And the second one was actually a woman who was originally from Holy Island in England. It's very close. It's like a little island near England, in England, in Great Britain. And she was living in Quebec and had a very, very strange set, numerous encounters with some type of beings out there. And I worked on that case for about a year and a half, was also very interested in it. She's now back in England. I haven't been in touch with her for a long time. Her name was Sarah. And I could say the Black Triangular Crafts, 100%. And her account was so incredibly interesting to me because she had so much detail to say that having, you know, worked in that field for a long time, she's probably one of the cases I would like to write a book on one day, but I think I'll hold off to that when I really get old. I'm only 51 now, so when I'm really, really old, I have nothing else to do, I'll probably write a book, you know, so.
Yeah, and you know what? Maybe when you're recovered and the voice is better and you're over the Bob Lazar hype, get you back on and we'll talk MUFON Canada, we'll talk investigations, We'll talk UFOs.
Sure.
But there's a lot to discuss about this work. And let's get into the documentary. So S4, the Bob Lazar story. How does this come about? Is this a project that found you or did you go looking for it?
I went looking for it. I always look for trouble. I'm always poking the bear, always. So I'll never stop poking the bear. I think it'll eventually kill me one day, but I don't care. I'm still going to do it. I wanted to build a really cool model of a flying saucer. I wanted to make a professional die-cast metal model of a flying saucer. That was my goal. I said, it doesn't exist. Nowhere on earth can somebody go on a store and say, I want to buy a flying saucer. It doesn't exist. You could buy like Hollywood flying saucers. You could buy, you know, 3D printed flying saucers that are like pretty basic and boring. I wanted something that was relatable to a real story, mm-hmm. and that had a lot of detail to it. And Bob Lazar was the only person who we knew, or I knew at the time, who not only had the opportunity to witness a craft on the inside, but also to analyze it. There's a difference between witnessing and running around in it or waking up on a table in it versus investigating it. So I took a chance. I reached out to his company. I spoke to Zach Zalewski, who works with Bob Lazar. I must have passed Zach's smell test, and he allowed me to speak to Bob Lazar. Bob said he would have been interested in speaking to me, found it interesting. They must have checked my website to see that I had some experience in all that in making products. I pitched the idea of making a model. And finally, Bob interviewed me wanting to know, how would I do this? And it worked. I apparently answered the right, you know, right. I answered all his questions the right way. And it sparked this project, which did not have the documentary film attached to it. And it just slowly, gradually built itself naturally as we were building the craft in a 3D environment, then building the hangar, then building the equipment around the craft, all in 3D in real size. And it got to a point where I was interested in allocating our budget to building the entire S4 facility. I asked Bob, would you support it if we did that? Bob was very gracious in providing us a lot of his time and answering a lot of our questions. He saw how serious we were. And him giving us the okay, basically, sure, I'll help you with that. We decided to invest a lot more money and resources, and we built it. And as we built it, we thought, well, this is an opportunity for you to talk to, for Bob, I said, for you to talk about what you saw and to correct all this bad information that's out there on the Bob Lazar story. And I don't think he was open to a documentary, even when I first pitched it. And eventually when he started seeing the base itself and we started showing him bits and pieces, it was becoming clear to him, like, this is a great opportunity to at least create a historical document, something that is accurate. It's not for entertainment purposes, but it's more educational, although we turned it into entertainment as well, obviously. But everything you see in our film, everything we did was very, very tightly managed by whatever Bob had said to us. We didn't go beyond it. So we never decided to embellish, add, change, modify. Everything was exactly as he saw it and as he experienced it. And I thought, this is the first time something like this has ever been done. So maybe it's the first of many for us. And we didn't know if people were going to like it. We put a lot of time into it. We were late in releasing it because of the amount of work that we had to do for the visuals. But it turned out to be a really good, it turned out to be a success, to be honest. So we're all very excited and very happy about it.
Take me back to the first time you heard the Bob Lazar story. You're about 10 years older than me. I've just turned 40. Like, so what were your honest impressions of hearing all of that?
I remember it. I was in Montreal and I was leaving for Italy. So I would go to Italy in the summer, and this happened in May. So I remember I was in Montreal. I believe I was 13, if I'm not wrong, or 13 or 14. I remember reading it. I heard it or saw it printed on a MUFON thing. Then I saw it on television. And then when I went to Italy, because I remember going to Italy about a month later for a few months, I was trying to track it from Italy and I couldn't. And I remember somebody, I don't remember who, but somebody had talked to me about it. And I remember going, wow, this is a big story. Like, it's even in Italy, they're talking about it. And came back. I must have been, again, 13 years old, and I started obsessing on all UFO stories. The Bob Lazar story was very interesting to me because I remember two things about it. The first one was that he had said that the crafts that he saw, he didn't just see one, he saw many, were intact. Mm-hmm. That was very new at the time. That was not something that people were discussing in the circle. I found that to be weird. I remember thinking, intact? Like, how? You know, like, how could we have intact vehicles? I remember everybody was talking about crashed flying saucers or crashed craft, but an intact one was kind of a very strange novelty. So that caught my attention. And that he kept insisting that it was the U.S. Navy that was in charge. And I remember thinking, the Navy? So both those things had raised red flags for me, I remember. And red flags, but not in a non-believing way. More so like, what is this about? Like, I want to know more. And then I saw the drawing or the recreation that he did of the sport model. And I remember it comparing it to the Billy Meyer images from the 1970s. And I thought, that's the same craft. That looks like the same thing. So I didn't know how to make that a conclusion with that, because at the time, Meyer had some very compelling images in the mid 70s that I really believe are real. But then Meyer came up with some weird, strange pictures later in his life that looked clearly fabricated, but they didn't look like the ones that Bob saw. The one that Bob saw looked like the original images that seem real from Meyer. So I thought, what the hell is going on here? And back in the 80s, everything was so taboo. Everything was so, you couldn't talk about flying saucers unless you wanted to get picked on or made fun of, or, you know, I wouldn't say discredited, but you were not taken seriously in the 80s. And so I spent a lot of time looking into it quietly, and I always felt that there was something that made me go, this sounds like it happened, but I don't know. You know, like, is it possible that we have intact vehicles? That was the thing that impressed me the most. So that was my first impression. I wasn't 100% sold, but I was also not discrediting it whatsoever. And over the years, obviously, a lot of information was circulating on Bob Lazar. Most of it was controversial. People were saying he doesn't have evidence of his education. He doesn't have evidence of having worked out there. But then his interviews also indicated that he said, I don't have evidence of my story. I wouldn't believe my own story if it, you know, which I found that to be very interesting, that his approach was very much, look, I wouldn't believe it either. I did continue to look into it on and off for the years, and then I let it go the same way the world let it go. If you think about it, for many years, the Bob Lazar story kind of just disappeared for decades. And suddenly in the, you know, 2018 or whatever, 2018-19, Jeremy Corbell resurfaced the Bob Lazar story, and he did an excellent job in bringing Bob back into the light, into the public sphere. And he brought him on Joe Rogan, which became a sensation. And I found that to be really interesting. And listening to Bob in those interviews made me go back into the originals. And I started really investigating it and thought, you know, we have to start looking at these accounts, these whistleblowers, these stories, witness accounts, whatever you want to call them, with a different light now. We have to say, okay, something is up. Something's happened. Is it all true? Is part of it true? There seems to be no doubt in my mind. There's no doubt in my mind that there seems to be a definite something going on. When I say something going on, I mean the government hiding something. And the fact that he exposed Area 51, he talked about Papoose Lake when nobody knew about it. George Knapp did an incredible job reporting on it and bringing out a lot of information that was in support of the story. George Knapp had witnessed the cloud chamber experiment with a puck that had a piece of element 115, which bent light. That made me start thinking, well, hold on. If Bob is a liar, then George is a liar. You know, I'm thinking, if George Knapp saw that, well, then he saw that. Otherwise, he's lying about that. Nobody can bend light. It's not, nobody could do that. I challenge anybody listening right now. I'll give you all the money the film made and times 100 if you could prove you could bend light. Okay? Like, bend light for me. Go ahead. Nobody could do that. So I find that to be extremely interesting. And then his friends, Gene Huff, in the past had said he had seen the craft in a test flight. That made me also say, what? So Gene Huff's in on it too? You know, like, so, and this, I address it because this is the way my brain was going through the data. I'm thinking, If I'm supposed to hear all the detractors, all the people that are saying it's not true, which I listen to, by the way, and I pay attention to it, but I don't see how all of what they're talking about affects the facts that he did mention things that were never mentioned before. He did identify things that were never talked about. So in 1989, he mentions Papoose Lake. Nobody knew about it. He refers to the craft in a way that is identical to the Billy Meyer craft, which, if you're making up a story in 1989 about UFOs, why would you associate the image of the craft to look like an image taken from somebody who had been discredited because of other pictures in the past?
Mm.
I found that to be very interesting. I'm like, why would he do that? It's such a suicide to the story. I mean, you just basically, you're going to hang your hat on something that was on a guy who was almost proven to have false, you know, faked some images, but not the original ones of the sport model looking craft. So I found that to be really interesting. Then he talked about the hand scanner. Everybody, and I mean everybody who always says that hand scanner was in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I remember that. I remember looking into that. I remember finding out about that. And I also remember never, ever, nowhere anybody was saying that that machine was measuring the bone length of your hand. Nobody ever said that. In Close Encounters, all we saw was a man putting his hand on a machine. And it made me think, yeah, so what? Like, if I would have been in 1977 and watched that, I would have thought maybe it's reading his palm print. Maybe it's reading his fingerprints. I wouldn't be thinking, oh, it's measuring the bones in his hand. So those were things that were like, wait a second, you know, how would he have known that unless he had seen this machine? So there's a lot of things that were starting to make sense to me. And then obviously the big ones, you know, were he had said that there was a stable version of Element 115. We still don't have one, but we did synthesize it. He had predicted, or didn't predict, he said that gravity was a wave and not a graviton. And he was right about that. We eventually, the LIGO Observatory actually observed that gravity is a wave. He had talked about the gravity A wave was 7.46 hertz. He said that in 1989. It was validated in 2023 in a scientific paper. There's no way he could have just randomly set a number and that's what it actually ends up being, mm-hmm. which I found to be really interesting. And a lot of detractors don't talk about that, but that's a scientific paper that validates a specific, very specific number that Lazar claimed what was the gravity A wave, and nobody talks about it because it's impossible to figure out how he knew that unless he actually was exposed to it. And then obviously all these whistleblowers, all these, you know, these stories that we're hearing in congressional hearings or whatever, everybody's saying, you know, the government has intact craft, the US Navy is involved, there's contractors, they've been trying to reverse engineer this. These are all verbatim words that Bob Lazar was the first guy to talk about almost 40 years ago. So, you know, whether there's a world where people who are obsessed with Bob having to have a paper from MIT or Caltech could actually accept the other facts and look at that and say, yeah, it's true. We can't figure out his education, but we also can't omit all these other facts because they do certainly point in that direction. So I think the story is probably one of the most important stories that we should pay attention to. I think it was important for us to build it as a historical, as a film. It was great entertainment, but it's also a historical document to have clarity on exactly what he saw. And I essentially hope that with all the evidence that we also show in the film with the hangar doors, there's a picture that we show in the film that shows the hangar doors in the side of a hill and also the manipulation of Google Earth on the area where Papoose Lake is, all things that, and showing that there's tracks, a lot of activity at Papoose Lake. I mean, all these things are pointing not to flying saucers from Zeta Reticuli. That's not what all these things are pointing to, but they're certainly pointing to, I don't think he was lying. Something's up. So yeah. Something's up, clearly.
That could have been the alternative title for this. S4, Something's Up.
Something's Up, right? Yeah.
I'll give your voice a minute because I'd like to see you've got a hoarse voice and it's not coming across, but I'll give you a chance to get a drink. And I think it's important I share with you what I think of the Bob Lazar story just to give context to everything else I'm going to ask.
Yeah.
And quite similar to a few things you've said there, to be honest, I had to write down as I was going along. I've always enjoyed and believed the Bob Lazar story, the core of it. You can't deny there are a lot of discrepancies along the way from Absolutely. Beginning to end. And there's some really intriguing things. I know there's a lot of folks who really want to tear the story down online. There's some folks who don't want to tear it down, but then maybe struggle with some of the missing detail, or there seems to be some inconsistencies here and there from what was said in the 80s to what was said in the early 90s to what was said now. Yeah. That can happen for multiple reasons. It's difficult to have the conversation with you about Bob because it's one I would love to have with Bob one day. But until I'm a California tech bro with resources to do that, that's probably not going to happen if you're listening, Bob. However, we can talk around it. So the academic stuff, yep, that's an issue for people. I've spoke to Knapp multiple times, and George always says there are ways and means you can attend certain places depending on what it is you're going to be doing that you don't have to. And for me, regardless of the Bob Lazar story, that seems logical that you could be somewhere, do a qualification and not necessarily have to have a register to say, yep, I'm here, sir, at the back of the class, okay? The Element 115 stuff, it seems like a slam dunk where we'll just show us the 115, but it degraded over time. Knapp saw it, so do you take Knapp's word? Do you not? People fall into those camps. And there's some other things. Bob's history with the brothel, if you're not familiar, I suppose, and I'm not, with Vegas, that whole area, the vibe, then some folks go, oh, well, why would, quote unquote, a pimp be involved in this? That's, again, thrown at Bob. But for me, I would go, well, you would take someone who is a little bit out the box, which Bob says himself was one of the characteristics they were looking for. You want someone a little bit different. Folks with Bob's level of intellect, genius, savvy, nous, way of thinking is the ideal candidate, because if I'm a government employee and I'm bringing on someone to this special access project that is way above top secret, presidents aren't finding out about it, it's multiple star generals who hear bits of a project that are in charge of these things, then you want to hire the guy that you can go, what, this guy, the guy that runs the brothel, the cookie guy that plays with his science experiments, his lab. It's so easy to discredit. Because I think that's one of those things when we've seen these whistleblowers come forward over the last couple of years. I think Grush was, if you were going to draw a whistleblower, what would that look like? What would it sound like? David Grush is probably a good example. Big strapping guy, really immaculate background, talks incredibly well and doesn't ever seem to trip up. But then you had other folks come forward and for no particular reason or in order, Jason Sands, Sarah Gamm, Lenville Logan, you know, any of these whistleblowers, Matthew Brown, Dylan Borland, and they're all very different. They look different. They aren't your archetypal types of people. And I always use the example, you can read the Harry Potter books, but then when you see someone's interpretation of that in a movie, it's not what you imagined. It's not the way you read the book. It's not what the school looked like, but this is their interpretation. And that's the way some folks have kind of treated this. So all that to say, I see holes in Bob's overall story. I see a lot of people picking at it in great minutiae and detail, but I can also sort of understand why that would be. So I think there's a core truth to what Bob's saying. And I'd like to ask you, so from your point of view, what I noticed watching this was, I didn't feel you were a documentary maker telling me, here's why you have to believe this story. This is the truth. It was more a presentation of, here are what we consider to be the facts. Here's what we consider to be some of the issues. Bob brings that up. And here is a new way. Like you mentioned, Corbell shared the story in your documentary form, very personal, one-to-one, following Bob about over a few months of his life and what happened and telling the story. You brought it to life with a new visual format because of new tools, new imagination, and access to Bob that people just don't generally get. Is that a fair way you wanted? And let me add one more thing for this never-ending question. Is it the documentary you started making that you ended up with, or did that change along the way?
Well, it's actually what I wanted, and I initially wasn't able to express properly what I wanted people to see. And I'm new at making films, by the way. So I also had to learn how to translate what I had in my brain to people as a storyboard and how I wanted it to be shown. There's a lot of things that I think we naturally brought into the film by just natural progression. But I did feel that the space itself, the actual UFO space, forget Bob Lazar now, but in general, this is where the WANA, this is where the We Are Not Alone had come in, is we have a tendency of approaching the subject always within the framework of the subject. We're always presenting a witness within that subject matter and not as a human. And I always found that to be frustrating, because as soon as you say, this person witnessed a flying saucer, now every time you talk to them, it's the context of that interview, of that story, is around a flying saucer. But that's not the person. The person witnessed the flying saucer, but they've also done a million other things. So it was important for me to show the human being behind this story, the person. I got to meet him, I got to spend time with him, and I got to see that there really was a human being behind the Bob Lazar story. Mm. And I wanted people to see that, because I thought, you know, we're constantly framing an interview very narrow. It's a very narrow framing. It's like, oh, we're going to talk about, you know, what you saw at S4. Exactly. Just talk about that. And you're constantly picking a person, everything they said for 40 years about one specific thing that happened to them, but you're not addressing their life, who they are, what they do. And this also applies for people like George Knapp or Dave Grush, or, you know, Everett Davis or Jacques Vallée. Like, what do these people do in their life? They're not they don't wake up in the morning, I'm going to talk about flying saucers and UFOs and UAPs. No, they have a life, and we don't do that enough. We kind of need to give this space a little bit of air and air out the room a little bit and say, let's get back to human interaction, and let's not attack people because the topic they're framed in doesn't fit the way you want them to be framed in. And that applies to me. You know, whenever I hear people picking up Bob's story, I imagine I put myself in his shoes at one point. I thought, imagine people would be picking at me every single time I talked about when I lived in Toronto 20 years ago. And I would say a story, and maybe I don't remember if I said it exactly the same way every time.
Yeah.
Because nobody cares. Who cares? You know, you're just relating an experience, a story. I'm not going to go and absolutely remember every detail and make sure it's the exact same. It's like, whatever. So, and your memory also changes over time. You get older, you change. I got old. I'm old. I'm 51. I don't remember what the hell I ate yesterday. I have to think about it before I answer, you know? So we cannot forget that there are human beings behind all this. Bob was just a normal guy. And regardless of the fact that he's an extraordinary person, he is just a guy. And he's interested in science. He's all he's done in his life is science. He's interested in doing experiments with explosives and chemicals and uranium and a vast array of different things that he's accomplished in his life. And it doesn't even talk about UFOs. It has nothing to do with flying saucers. And so I thought, isn't that interesting? And his friends and the people near him always would say to me, That's not Bob Lazar. Bob Lazar has nothing to do with flying saucers. It's a, it happened to him in 1988 and 89, but that's not who he is. And I thought, you know, I gotta listen to that. Because if I was in the Army when I was 18, 19 years old, but that's not who I am. I'm not a military guy. I was in it, but that's not who I am. So if imagine everyone would be framing me as what I did in the Army back in 1990, 91, 92, it's not me. It's just something I did. So I hope the film accomplished, that's what I wanted to accomplish with the film, is also show a little bit of who the man is and was while that was happening to him, and not because that happened to him.
Yeah. Do you feel the story weighs on Bob? Did you get that feeling when you were with him?
1,000,000%. 1,000,000%. I mean, it's probably something that, from what I'm understanding and what I understood, he thinks about it all the time. Not in an obsessive way, but more in a cure. He'll be eternally curious because everything that is happening in the world, he can't unsee that. So of course that plays into his mind. He experienced that. So it's like, you know, whatever is happening worldwide, whether it be technology, wars, trade, whatever is happening, well, that's also happening. So how is it connecting to everyday life? It's a very, of course it weighs on him. Absolutely.
So let me ask you about the, and this is what I have to, I say apologize. I don't feel I have to apologize. I'm never really sorry for much unless I, yeah. Well, no, fuck it. I won't then. Yeah. No apology for me. No. Yeah. So I commented, I done like a kind of on the spot review of the documentary, and I ran through my notes and stuff on one of my shows. And I commented, and as someone making a documentary, well, for the first time, so you might not take this to heart as much, I said, you know, the use of AI is really good. And people online were like, it's not AI, it's CGI. This is all handcrafted. And I was like, well, I said, I didn't know that. I think someone said it was like 99% CGI. And I said, look, my point is, as someone who is not artistic in the slightest, I draw stick figures still like I did as a kid. I'll use AI software now, like everyone does, to create small clips to put into some of my videos. They're like 5 and 10 second clips. They look amazing compared to what was capable people were capable of a few years ago. So I wasn't being detrimental, and this is to the dickheads on YouTube, and it's a small number, but you know, hear me out. I was like, I'm just saying that AI looks really good, and some of these recreations look like that. So if someone spent 3 years handcrafting it, cool, great, I'm more than happy to take that back. But if you don't mind, for those who wanted to scold me, not that I lose sleep over it, what was the process around actually creating the visuals? Because that's a huge part of what this is.
Oh, there's no question that represents, the visuals represent at least 70, 80% of the whole project. I mean, that was a huge endeavor, okay? And we started it in December of 2021. And so, if we were to go back with AI, there was no AI in December 2021. Yeah. There was no AI in December 2022. You know, there was barely anything in 2023. So we started it off with a combination of Blender and Unreal Engine. We built the craft with Blender, and we built the hangar with Unreal Engine 4 at the very beginning. We eventually built most of the front side of the facility in Unreal Engine 4 and then transferred to Unreal Engine 5. as we were integrating all of it in the engine, we were trying to get cinematic shots out of it. Unreal Engine started coming up with some really cool new cinematic upgrades, but it still didn't do the trick. And unfortunately, Unreal Engine is not designed for really good quality VFX. It's more of a game, video game software.
That's how I know it from PlayStation. Yeah.
Right. And so we eventually transferred everything over to Blender and spent a good 2.5, 2 years and a bit, maybe more, 2.5 years of absolutely painstaking amount of work in Blender to actually build S4, the sport model, the other crafts, the landscape, Papoose Lake, Papoose Mountain Range, all the way to Groom Lake. So that was all hand done, handmade in Blender. When we were doing the renders for the film, they're all in 4K. I mean, they're incredible quality renders that you cannot get in AI, you can't do with AI. But then AI came in, and AI was rolling into the world while this was happening. And as AI got in, we were like, this is crazy for us if we don't learn from it, right? And one of the things that we started using AI for early on was not using AI to make the visuals. We were using AI to teach us about how to light a scene in Blender. So you would sometimes have the scene in Blender, turn on the lights, and there was always those moments where we were like, this is not, there's something wrong here, you know? And then you would take something similar in AI, and AI showed us a glare on a brick, example, on a piece of material. And we had not toggled on the reflection tab on some of the materials in Blender. And we thought, shit, we need to do that. So we would do that, and it would increase the quality of that visual, and thought, oh, that's that. No, that's how it should be. So we used AI to help us light the scene, teach us how to light the scenes for real in Blender. And that was a really interesting learning experience. And at the very, very end, we were struggling, saying, should we use some AI stuff in the film to complete the scenes or put a bow on the scenes? Should we do that? Or should we not do that? Because if we do that, then people might think all of it is AI. And the answer was, they're going to think it's all AI anyway. The reality is, people will just think it's AI. So we thought, all right, let's just make the visuals even better. So it's essentially 90% Blender, 10% AI. And that's an accurate estimate of the work that we did. And when it comes to actors, it's 85% real actors, 85% real actors, 10% de-aged actors, 5% AI. That's an accurate number.
And all those real actors are human, no NHI.
Yeah. Only one of them is not. Only one was Dennis Mariani. Dennis Mariani is actually a non-real person in the film. Yeah.
Full on hybrid. And that's totally fair. And like I say, there was all the talk beforehand, it was going to be like a full on virtual immersive experience. A lot of folks asked me to put that to you to say, is there going to be an option to wear a headset to be there to walk through? Like
that's actually the biggest thing we're working on right now. So I can say that I'm excited that the film is out. I want people to watch it. As many people as can watch the film to at least really see what Bob saw and to prove that we made all this, it'll be the AI experience, the VR experience, not the AI, the VR experience that's going to come out is 100% going to allow people to walk into S4, use equipment, pick stuff up, open doors, turn on lights and turn off lights, walk around, go in the lab, play around with stuff, go in the hangar, go in the craft, do whatever you want. It's a real 3D world that we built. So that's coming.
That'll be cool. And the first thing I said would be, people have to mod that and have the Xenomorphs from Alien inside S4, have them running around as you kind of escape with Bob. That'll be cool, and I appreciate you clearing that up for us, because there are people who are really interested in the graphics, how it's made, the engineering of the documentary, and like you say, it's such a big part of bringing the story to life. And even if you're immersed in the Bob Lazar story, I'm pretty familiar with it. Not every, my memory's dog shit, right? I'm terrible, so I'm hearing a lot of things that I'm remembering or misremembered, but you've now got all these visuals with it, and it just brings that to life for you, especially when you know it's from Bob's own mouth. What kind of details and conversations, though, did you have with Bob where he maybe said something and was like, you can't put that in the documentary, though? What level of detail is perhaps either missing, or was there stuff he told you where you went, just because of X, I can't put that in?
I forced them to give me, I really forced Bob to give me an answer on education at a certain point, because I said, look, we got to cover this. And he gave me a very long, detailed explanation of what happened at MIT. But I could not put that in the film, because there's a legal component to it that neither did my E&O insurance want me to put in there, in the event that I could cause a problem. So I had Bob not wanting it in there because it's a national security issue. And two, I didn't feel like I had enough protection for the film to do something like that, where it could get a strike down or I could get some legal problem with the film. When people make YouTube videos or when people make social media videos, it's very different than when you produce a film and want the film to pass all the legal hurdles to put it out to the world. There are a lot of legal hurdles to go through. And in Canada, where I am, the legal hurdles are way more difficult than they are in the United States. Way more, okay? So if we pass the legal requirements in Canada, we're fine in the USA. So there were a lot of things that my lawyer had raised red flags on and said, you're going to have a problem with this, you're going to have a problem with this. So there was a few things we had to remove, because they're essentially opening Pandora's box to potentially putting other people's lives, not in danger, but exposing other people's activities. Mm-hmm. And it's not a necessary thing. It's not something that I wasn't out to go, aha, let's put these people out there and let's let them talk too. That's not my goal. I'm not that. I encourage people to encourage investigative journalists to do that. I encourage people of all walks of life to do their own research and investigations. I do not want to be the shit disturber to other people's lives. And as a result, I'm providing everyone what I can factually present from the story without causing a legal, putting it in legal peril. Let's put it that way.
And that particular thing, without giving away detail, that would have cleared up Bob's whole academic background. Is that
not the whole academic background, but certainly without a question, the MIT one.
Okay.
Undeniable. Okay. So when I found out about it, I can tell you that there is a big aha moment that we all had. It literally is like, oh my God. Yeah. And you suddenly go, that's why. And you realize that there are many different ways of going to MIT. Not everybody goes to MIT the same way. Okay. And yep. If anybody from MIT is listening and they went to MIT the traditional way, they might not even believe what I'm saying, but anybody working for the government anybody working for National Defense who has been sent to MIT and they're listening, I guarantee you they're nodding going, yeah, there's a lot of ways to go to MIT. So there is no doubt in my mind that he went there. There's no doubt in my mind that there's record of other people that went there that don't show up at MIT, by the way. And as I said in a previous interview, not everything the government does is legal.
I'm shocked.
Okay. Yeah. So it's really important to remember not everything they do is above board. So they don't want us to know they do illegal things. And they don't do illegal things without help. So they have people do it. And sometimes those people have to go to MIT.
I can't believe that's still true in 2026, that the government's doing illegal things, especially in the United States.
Right? Yeah, right. Yeah.
I'm not having Luigi slandering the US government on this podcast. And that goes for most governments. And before anyone goes, oh, the UK's, they're all the same. They all do the same shit.
They're all the same.
I wonder, how did you deal with some of the more, and it sounds ridiculous, the more extreme evidence and parts of Bob's story? It's almost easier to look at the schematics, the here's what the craft was like inside, here's the chairs, here's where the propulsion device was. That's all very process driven. It's all matter of fact. You then have the side of the story with Zeta Reticuli, the kids, the potential disinformation, Bob seeing stuff written down that he's like, and even he was honest to say, this might have been there for me to read and divulge deliberately as a way to misinform.
Absolutely.
How did you then deal with that side of the story as part of the documentary? And what are your thoughts on that side of the story anyway?
I can tell you that the biggest struggle of what is in my documentary with Bob Lazar is exactly that. Everything that was written in those documents, he did not really want me to put in the documentary because he did not feel that they were factual to him because he didn't see it. He didn't actually experience it. But my argument to Bob was, I don't care. You experienced that at S4. You went through those documents. That's what they said. And so Bob said, absolutely, but I don't know if they're real. And so I said, so let's say something about that. Don't omit them. Include them, but with that caveat that says maybe this was purposeful misinformation. Personally, this is my personal opinion. This is not Bob's opinion, my opinion. I think in those documents there was some factual information from what he remembers, information regarding Project Galileo, which is the project that he worked on. A lot of information, most of it was very accurate. That's what he said, because he was able to validate it. He doesn't know much about Project Looking Glass and about Project Sidekick because he wasn't able to validate the projects, but he does believe that some of that information might have been accurate because of how the propulsion system of the craft worked. And the directives that they had at Project Galileo. I personally do not believe the Zeta Reticuli portion of the story. He doesn't believe it either way. He says it's just words on paper. For me, the project the Zeta Reticuli is a very interesting data point because it refers to something that Betty and Barney Hill had mentioned in the 60s in their experience. And I find that to be a little bit strange that it happens to be in a government document. This is my personal opinion, but I could be wrong. I could be wrong, and they are from Zeta Reticuli. So this is my personal opinion. The fact that there was an autopsy report in the documents, he really was very adamant that they did. It did look like a real picture, two pictures. One of them was the being, the upper torso of the being with the T-shaped cut and the skin peeled back, and then the organ that was on a table or on a plate or something. He said there was multiple handwritten notes on those pictures. He says they were doctors who had written handwritten. They were original handwritten notes, different color pens. He says it looked authentic. Is it real? He never saw a being. I believe that is possible. I do believe that was possible. And then the whole, you know, humans are containers that, you know, they had a hand in making us, that they're really old and they were part of our genetic construction. Why would the government know this? Why would it be in a document? Why would it be important to say that to a guy who's being hired to reverse engineer a propulsion system? Why would you even say that to somebody? I find that to be questionable. So I don't know if I believe that, and I don't believe Bob believes that, but he says that's what was in the documents. So
another piece of evidence, and I think the first thing I saw when the documentary dropped, because I think it came out a few hours early or a day early in the UK.
Or
in the US as well, maybe. I saw folks posting online and people were like, it's out. And then on the Discord chat, folks like, not available here, but I am. I can get it. So I straight on Amazon. I actually, you owe me because I rented it and bought it. Because I rented it, watched half of it, had to do something, didn't go back to it for 48 hours. And then bought it. So don't worry, Luigi. You're making up to me here. Consider that your payment, right?
I appreciate that.
You can drop a message for me. But the first thing I saw online was the hillside photo, and I wonder, did you see this dropping online? And for folks unaware, I'll pop it on the YouTube screen. But the image of the alleged hangars that Bob described, with the slanted hillside, almost invisible look to them, which would make sense. You wouldn't want these things to look like big metallic hangars out in the desert. The end one being a little bit bigger because that's where the bigger craft was. And using imagery techniques and whatnot, you've brought out the best quality you can to show the hangars. That caused all kind of debate online from sides. Talk about that for me.
So initially when that happened, and I was... somebody mentioned to me, go check out what's going on X. You know, a lot of people are talking about the hangar doors. I thought, here we go. You know, let's see what happens. So there were people who were taking pictures or screenshots of their computer and utilizing the raw image as the look. There's nothing there. Or taking a screenshot of one of the frames in my film prior to showing it being, you know, really showing the detail in the image and saying, look, there's nothing there. It's just noise. This is ridiculous. There's nothing there. Now, what's really important to say here is that I was contacted by a guy called Scott Mitchell who had initially brought us this information. And this came to us a year and a half before we decided to put it in the film. We hyper scrutinized this. We didn't just scrutinize it a little bit. I'm obsessive, by the way. If there's anybody in the world who is insane when it comes to detail, I raise my hand, okay? I am absolutely obsessed with details. So I was not going to allow this to be part of my film unless I had people, multiple different people, validate that data independently without me sharing the image. Meaning they got to go find it. They got to do their own due diligence and find that you come to the same visual conclusion that there's some geometric shape into that hill. This was obviously accomplished by people. And on top of that, we made sure that we forensically analyzed the whole image. Not only that image number, by the way, is 0501. That is the image of what we show in the film. But the photographer who took those took about 10 pictures prior to it and 10 pictures subsequent to it.
Yeah.
All those pictures are like, tock, 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 tock. It's not like he took one, waited 5 minutes, and no, it was like one after the other, as most of us would have done had we been given access inside Area 51 with a fucking camera. I would have been shooting a trillion pictures. I would have had that. I would have brought 80 cameras with me, point them everywhere, and take every possible shot possible.
Yeah.
So good on him that he did that, because he provided everybody, not just us, a multitude of different high resolution images, raw images that you can analyze. When you forensically analyze 0501, you will notice that as you bring out some of the contrast, depending what softwares you use, by the way, we were able to quickly, we have a whole video, by the way, I should actually post it. There's a video of us, we screen recorded our screen, put the raw image. We show you what we select to go and pull out all that quality in the image. Because there's a lot of people, they're like putting filters, like, I can't see it, I can't see it. But eventually, if you toggle the right tools, you will see it. And it only shows there. It doesn't show elsewhere in the image. You do not see that specific geometric geometric formation right at the exact place where they're supposed to be. Not near it, right dead on. So there's no question that there's a absolute unequivocal geometric shape right in the side of that hill. There's no question about that. We have enough evidence to prove that. People were upset because they were saying it's grainy, it's crap, it's not good enough. That's forensic analysis. You're not going to get a 4K image up close through a picture like that. That's not going to happen. Okay. So we are obviously working with what we can find, and we were able to get that. And that, to me, was a big deal, because we were able to confirm it, replicate it, and we were also able to have other people do the same thing independently. That was important. I didn't want it to be, oh, we have the exclusive picture, you can only get it through us. No, that would never made it. If the picture was better, if the picture showed even more details, but I was the only one who had it, I wouldn't have put it in the film. Because that means that I could manipulate what is in the film. But I did not want that, especially when it came to hard evidence. So I saw all that online and I thought, they're really going a little bit too fast here. They're judging without proper information. They don't, the detractors highlight saying it's just pixels, it's just noise, it's snow in the image. No, it's not. It's not. I don't care what they're saying. It's just not. Scientifically, it's either or it's not. And it's not that. It's a real thing that's there. And they say, oh, you see it all over the picture. No, we forensically analyzed it. Show us, give us all the data and we'll accept it. But we didn't find it all over the picture. And when you validate 0500 or 0499 or 0502 and 0503, they're there as well. So it's not one picture only. So the forensic analysis was done very meticulously, very carefully. I was not going to hang my hat on something like that unless I was able to do it. I commend Scott Mitchell for having done that work and realizing that and bringing it to us, to our attention. I think he deserves a lot of credit for having done that. He's a great researcher out there, and you should check him out. I think he also goes under the name Weisberger. So he's a pretty cool loose cannon that I love very much, and I've talked to him many times over the years, and I think he's a really good dude. A lot of other things he's discovered are interesting. They're not as verifiable or confirming mm-hmm. something as this piece here. So I do believe that is 100% in that image, which, by the way, I say it in my film, it doesn't prove flying saucers.
Yeah,
it doesn't. I never said this proves flying saucers. All I said is, what's there? What is that? That's exactly what Bob Lazar said in 1989. Why would we not consider that interesting? Well, is the government trying to fool us by building it after Bob went public? Like, what are we, fucking crazy? No, that is 100% evidence that should slowly lean the argument to say, maybe he did see that. Forget the flying saucers, but he did mention hangar doors in the side of a hill, and they're camouflaged. They're not meant to be seen, but we could clearly see that. So let's not throw that out. It's important.
I'll say two things on that, and you present your case well. One is the UFO community, the skeptics and the debunkers on both sides of this will always see what they want to see. And if you look at, let's just say, someone who's famous for posting pictures of orbs constantly, some of us will see the International Space Station or a bird as and when you see the wings flapping. Other folks will just downright tell you, no, it's an orb, and they have seen something similar.
But I agree.
Then on the other side of it, you've got skeptics and debunkers that just want to find the tiny detail that might be something prosaic. And sometimes you have to go, no, that even arrow that looks largely disinformation-y has come out and said there are things that they can't identify, and they've just filed those off to the side. But look at all the stuff we have identified, and that's not the point. The other one is, like you've kind of mentioned and alluded to, the hill is designed to not be seen. It's not meant to be hangars that say hangar one, hangar two outside of it with a button you press for the shutter to go up. These right. are to be hidden, not even from the public. These were designed to be hidden from, I'm guessing, China, Russia, private exactly. contractors, all these kind of entities, okay? Never mind someone thinking 40 or 50 years ago there's going to be a guy with an iPhone 17 Pro Max that's going to take pictures of these from a really cool drone they can now buy, right? That wasn't considered, but these hills were designed to be hidden. And I'm sure there's all kinds of other stuff out there even Bob wasn't exposed to that we still don't know.
Absolutely.
And that's not even me giving my opinion. However, I'm going to ask you for a few more minutes of your time, Luigi, because you've been really good. And I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. The first one might be difficult to answer, but even after all of this, everything you've went through, the time you've spent with Bob, the research, the work you've done, is there any aspects of Bob's story, even now, you still look at and go, I either don't believe it or I don't find it convincing?
Where I think he's omitting information, I don't think that Bob Lazar is lying. I believe that Bob Lazar is omitting information. I've said this many times and I'll continue saying it. I don't know if Bob likes that I say that sometimes, but I don't think he minds it that much. It's not like he doesn't say it openly. He's actually said that I don't say everything just in case there's some information out there that ever comes out, I could validate it instead of me saying everything, and then people could use my information and make up their own stories. I believe there's something missing in the story. There's a couple of things missing in the story. I don't push him on it. I don't press him on it because Bob's not going to talk anyway. If he doesn't want to say it, he won't say it, and I'm not going to... Why would I push the man for no reason? if I don't want to tell you something, you could beg me. I'm still not going to tell you. So it's part of our lives, right? One of the things that I have trouble with is the trip to Los Alamos with a piece of Element 115. There's a piece missing in that story. There's an omission there, and I'll leave it at that. I don't know. Maybe the whole story is there, or maybe there's a little omission somewhere. Whatever the case is, I'm not pressing him. Another thing that I find really interesting is the last meeting, the last time he met with Dennis Mariani at the Union Plaza Casino in Las Vegas. There's omitted information there, and I don't know what it is, and I'm not going to pretend to know what it is. So does it really matter in the whole story? No, it's not omissions that remove the credibility of the story. Not at all. Not at all. I believe that they're just additional pieces of information that can open up more doors. And so as far as him being brought into S4, having been exposed to the materials in the lab, working on the reactor, the Element 115, the craft, the sport model, and the programs that were out there, the projects that were out there, I'm at a good 99% high conviction that happened to him. It's also hard to translate human interactions, Andy. It's not easy. You and I are talking right now. I'm in Montreal. You're in England. Reality is, there's still no human contact here.
Yeah.
If you and I were sitting in the same room, it would be different. You would actually see what I look like. I would actually see what you look like. We would grab a drink together, have some coffee. We would laugh about something. And there's always a different vibe when you're with a person. There is not one single time, not one, that I or my team questioned Bob Lazar when he was talking about what happened. Now, there's people who say that, oh, I believe that he believes his story. I find that to be a little bit of a lazy comment, because by saying I believe he believes his story means that you believe it's possible that it's a lie and he believes his own lie. I don't believe that he believes his story. I believe the story. I don't think he's that good of a liar. He doesn't come across to me as a liar. We spent 4.5 years together. We've become friends. Every time I talk about anything with Bob Lazar, it has nothing to do with S4 at all. I've spoken to him about a million and one things. Never did I feel that he's a somewhat of a compulsive liar or some weird characteristic that I have to watch for. Not even one time. It's a difficult thing for me to translate to the people because it's personal. I experienced it as a person. I have a very good bullshit meter myself. My sister Veronica that works with me is possibly the best bullshit meter I've ever met in my life. And she didn't believe Bob Lazar nor his story when she first found out about it because she didn't even know what it was. And after all these years, not only does she believe Bob Lazar, she also believes that there's flying saucers in the hands of the government, which was a big step from absolutely not knowing what this is all about. And why? Because she says, I'm not feeling that he's lying. So a lot of people hate that because there's no evidence to what I'm saying there. It's just my personal, okay, why should we trust you? Don't trust me. I'm not saying trust me. I'm not a trust me bro, by the way. I'm not one of those. So I'm not doing the trust me bro. I invite all the skepticism, all the questions, they're all valid. Even the holes in the story, they're absolutely valid. Even Bob will tell you they're valid, but we cannot omit the evidence that we do have. And we cannot pretend it's not fitting in well. We have to keep that there. You could have been an asshole when you were 15 years old, and you could have been a bully to kids, and you ended up becoming the super nicest guy in the world later in your life. So let's not omit that I really think it happened. But yeah, he's a weird guy. He had a pirate flag outside his house. He built jet cars out of a Honda. He blew up bombs in the desert. He worked in a brothel. He got arrested for pandering. It's not a lot. We're not pretending that didn't happen, but it doesn't mean that didn't happen either. So,
yeah,
you know, I think partially that was also by design, if you want my opinion.
And you said it was December 2021 you started this journey.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
November, it was actually end of November. I looked up my emails. It was okay. End of November. Yeah, yeah.
In that time, you'll have been with Bob as we had the first hearings,
yeah.
Congress taking up interest in this, David Grush coming forward, Matthew Brown coming forward, all of that. His friend George Knapp sitting in front of Congress. At some point, at least once, you must have turned to Bob and said, why are you not doing this?
Yes, 100%, a million times. And Bob answers, I don't have to. He says, I've said my story almost 40 years ago. He says, I'm not signing any of their papers. I'm not letting them put me in some type of a restrictive situation. I don't need this in my life. I don't need people to believe this story. I've done everything. I've already ruined my life enough, he said. I've already gone dragged through the coals. He said it to me. He says, I got dragged through the coals for decades. He says, I did this. He was saying this to me. I did this with you, Luigi, because you could correct a lot of the misinformation on my story out there. That's all. That's the only reason why I did it. He doesn't make money from it. He doesn't. But in fact, not only does he doesn't make money, I have to say this, his wife wouldn't let me pay for his air ticket to go to the Joe Rogan thing in Austin. His wife wouldn't let me pay for the ticket when he came to Montreal on the last trip. I couldn't pay for it. They wouldn't let me give them the money. So he's paid for his own tickets. He doesn't take any money from this. He's helped us. And he says, I did this because I saw so much bullshit out there about my story that I just wanted it to be at least clear. And I believe that you did a great job in making it visually clear. But as far as going to Congress, I don't need to do that. It's not something that George Knapp has asked them many times. And Bob said, I'm happy where I am. I'm about to retire. I don't want any of this. When I made him do the interview, I got him the interview on Area 52 with Chris Ramsey. I got him the interview with Jesse Michaels on American Alchemy. He did, obviously, Joe Rogan. Clearly, he did Joe Rogan with me. And the amount of times that I said to Bob, so people see all these interviews, right? They've seen him on Area 52, on Jesse Michaels, on Rogan. I think there was a little bit on Richard Dolan. And everybody's like, well, look at him. He's a grifter. He's doing all these interviews. Oh, my God, no. To get him to accept that was insanely hard. And I would love, I'm not going to do it because it's none of their business, but the amount of people he refused, the list of is absolutely insane by gigantic mainstream media platforms. And he said, no, I'm done. I don't want to do this. If he wanted to grift, if he wanted to take advantage, oh, he could. Believe me, he could. It's like pulling teeth out of a dinosaur with Bob to make him do something. And I can't thank him enough for having done what he did with us. I can't thank him enough for all his time. And every single time he answered my emails or our Zoom calls with questions of, you know, is the table there or is the table there? You know, and he would be like, it doesn't matter. I don't remember where the fuck the table was. You know, it was in the hangar. You know, he wasn't paying attention at the table. So, but the amount of stuff that we've called him on, and he's been amazing. And I don't think he wants to be in the spotlight anymore. I think he's really like, he wants to retire. He's happy. He's got a wonderful wife, a wonderful little home life. He does his work for United Nuclear and he does his home experiments, which I enjoy going and watch when I see him at his house. But he doesn't believe, by the way, and this I can say openly, he does not believe we're going to get disclosure at all. He believes that something will come out. He believes that we're going to get some information, no question, but not all the way to what was happening at S4, nor what is possibly happening right now. I personally don't think so either. So he says, so what? What do I do with, what am I going to do in Congress? Talk to people who also lie? Because he also doesn't believe some, by the way, let's also address the pink elephant in the room. Congress people don't always say the truth, by the way. So, okay, let's not make them look like they're all angels up there where, you know, they got blessed by the Pope every morning when they go talk. Like, give me a fucking break. Like, everyone's a bullshit artist up there too. So let's address that also. Because I think a lot of people really, really give them a lot of credit sometimes.
Yeah, I don't buy the whole, oh yeah, they're under oath. So? That's just an easy getaway for me for a lot of folks. And listen, you've been great with your time, Luigi. One more thing then. And by the way, I agree with the Grifton stuff. Some people will totally disagree with you with Bob. Others won't. I've got one of Bob's signed pictures and he's to Andy, that UFO podcast. Yeah. Fuck off. No, I won't come on your show. I bought it a few years. He didn't say that, but he signed it a few years ago. I always think Bob could, whatever he has made or does make, don't give a shit, he could have done more. He could have been at every contact in the desert. He could have been at every Conscious Life Expo. He could have done a yearly Bob Lazar cruise around the Maldives. And he hasn't.
He hasn't. And I can add one more thing. I know, I'm in the know, that he turned down some pretty big, serious money by some Hollywood execs, okay? I'm talking big money. And he turned it down.
Is that a trust me, bro?
Yeah, that's a trust me, bro. Trust me, bro. Yeah. That's my first trust me, bro. I mean, he turned it down. That blew my fucking mind because I'm like, he really doesn't care. Like, he doesn't need it. It's not like he's a hungry person for money. They live such a modest life. He meant that when he said it on Joe Rogan. I drive an $18,000, you know, car, and he's really, they're very modest people, you know? So
yep.
I always say, God, he's got so much potential. He could write a book, at least write a book. You can make money writing a book. He doesn't want to do that. He doesn't even want to do that. So it's like, he says, you know, the posters, because, you know, he's got posters that he's signing, right? People are like, oh, look at that. He's grifting. He's signing. He's charging money for posters. You would not believe how annoyed he is when he sees, like, oh my God, I got to sign 200 posters. So he's just like, all right, what's, you know, it's not Bob. It's not him. So I find that hilarious when I hear the grifting. He calls me a griftologist because people started calling me a grifter. So he says, no, Luigi, you're better than I am. You're a griftologist, you know? And I'm like, I guess that's what we are in the eyes of some people, because we decided to invest all our money with no guarantees on a film that thank God, is making some money back for us. But I had no guarantees. I put seven figures of my own money in this for 4.5 years. So fuck anyone who thinks I'm a grifter, because they're crazy if that's the case. And Bob is, I think Bob and Joy are by far the furthest grifting type of people I've ever met in my life. Undeniable. That's another trust me, bro, by the way.
Yeah, I'll take your word on that. And I've actually got two questions, very short though. The first one, you said on Weaponized, something different is happening soon on Amazon. Now, the documentary is available on multiple platforms. Are you in a place yet to let people know what that is, what's coming, what's different?
Well, we actually, I can't say that yet. I can say that it is now available in Australia. We are about to open markets in Sweden, Finland, Portugal, Brazil, and I can't remember another country. I can't remember. On our wearenotalone.com platform, by tomorrow, the film will be available in 11 different languages, dubbed in 11 different languages, not subtitled, meaning you can actually watch it in Chinese, Chinese, Portuguese, German, French, Spanish, I believe it's Polish, Russian, Vietnamese, Arabic, and I can't remember another one. But there's a lot of new languages that are coming out. I'm excited about that because it's going to open up more people to watch it, you know? So, and that's all on our dollar, by the way. So for all the people who call me a grifter, I had to pay for that. That's out of my pocket. That nobody gives that as a free thing. It's not free, by the way. So, yeah.
And at this point, it's been a couple of weeks. It's been out. There are still people that may not have seen it. I've got listeners in all of those countries you listed, which is crazy, VPNs or not. What's your elevator pitch to anyone who hasn't watched it or has maybe held off watching it because they're not sure?
Look, I highly recommend you watch it, at least whether you believe the Bob Lazar story or not, whether you believe it or not. I respectfully ask people to look at it, suspend judgment for a second, and at least watch it to at least get the data straight, the points. I've had a lot of people attack Bob Lazar, talking to me, attacking the Bob Lazar story, but their data is wrong. So I have to stop them immediately and say, hold on, you're not, we can't have the conversation. You have to correct the source data and then we can discuss. So there's a lot of things that we've made very clear in our film. And so I invite a lot of people to watch it, at least to get the information right. If you don't believe it, fine. Let's argue from there. But let's not argue from what's on the internet, because there's a lot of bad information on the internet, unfortunately. Yeah.
That's a bombshell to end on. There is bad information on the internet, folks.
Yeah.
But listen, it's available on multiple platforms. I'll put the links below for you, folks. Thank you, Luigi, for your time. It's been great speaking with you, and I would love you back on to talk about your work with MUFON, talk about UFOs more generally, and speak about you and your experiences, and enough about Bob, and let him enjoy his retirement.
Good. Yeah, anytime. Yeah.